Committee on Human Services will come to order, please. Wait for the vice chair to get here. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623. We may interrupt our public hearing when Senator Morris gets here to testify on a bill that we have later today. We're going to extend the courtesy of having him testify so he can go back to his other committee assignment, but he is not here, and I'm not sure when he's going to show up, so we will start our public hearing on 623. You want to...
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 623 simply repeals Section 8, Chapter 174 of Oregon Law 2003 and declares an emergency effective upon passage. In the background on your staff measure summary is a verbatim copy of Section 8. And basically what Section 8 states is that if a rule adopted by the Oregon Department of Administrative Services under Section 5 of the 2003 Act, which was Senate Bill 875, is not approved by the 73rd Legislative Assembly, the rule is repealed January 1st, 2006. And so basically what this, what Senate Bill 623 does is take that out of statute that the Legislative Assembly must approve the rules. And there are also some proposed -1 amendments that you should have in front of you. They require the program rules be submitted to the Legislative Assembly at the beginning of each session and go into effect on January 1st, following the close of that session, unless the legislature approves an earlier effective date. And it also allows the legislature to, by statute to amend, appeal, or supplement any rules. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Bruce Goldberg and Missy Dolan, would you please come up?
For the record,
I'm sorry. Go ahead and say a word about the interpreter.
We do have an American Sign Language interpreter in the room who, during the testimony, if she cannot pick up something being said, will cue the chair to ask for it to be repeated, so just be aware of that. Thank you.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. We're here today. I always come with fantastic staff.
Oh.
And rather than listening to me, I'm going to turn things over to Missy Dolan to talk about, give you a quick briefing on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which we're proud to say began today.
Good. Thank you, Bruce. Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz and committee members, I just would like to review the slides in front of you and give you an overview of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. For the record, I am Missy Dolan, and I am the administrator for the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. The 72nd Legislative Assembly approved Senate Bill 875, which established the Oregon Prescription Drug Program for uninsured individuals and government groups. The program was actually launched today. Last night we mailed 1,159 ID cards, and we have two-thirds of Oregon's pharmacies already signed up. Individuals who are eligible for this program include Oregon residents who are at least 54 years old at 185% of the federal poverty guidelines, who have had no private prescription drug coverage for at least 6 months. Eligible agencies include PEB, cities, state agencies and counties, school districts, seniors covered under the existing RX program, of which there are only a couple hundred, and Oregon Health Sciences University. The savings that we're estimating for the uninsured Oregonians will be from 15 to 60%. If we only had the 1,159 people who are already enrolled for the duration of this program, they would save $287,000 by year end 2005. If we enroll the budgeted number, the goal that we're hoping to enroll of uninsured of 21,000 by year end, savings will be closer to $3 million. And if we meet our target at the end of a two-year period, of 46,200 uninsured, we're talking over $10 million in savings. That's based on utilization statistics that we received from the state of Arizona on a similar program, and it's based on the estimated savings from this program. Advantages for groups. We have negotiated a transparent contract with WHI, which is Walgreens Health Initiatives. Transparency means that there is no spread between what's being paid to pharmacies and what's being charged to groups. It means that rebates from manufacturers will go directly to groups, depending on their direct utilization, and there will be no withhold of their rebate dollars. A fixed rebate amount manufacturer negotiation fee has been negotiated with WHI. Participating groups will also help reduce the cost on the uninsured population, because the administrative fee that we're being charged for the uninsureds will actually go away as our group enrollment increases, because we're giving WHI the opportunity to make sales for their drug management services. The preferred drug list for the OPDP that is being developed is really the most compelling and credible part of this program, I feel. I think that it's a vision that Senator Morissette and his peers had when they wrote Senate Bill 875 to bring evidence-based research at and the lowest possible cost into this program, and I feel like that is really the underscored mission of this program. How are we going to measure success? We're going to deliver value by increasing pharmaceutical compliance by the uninsured, and by reducing the cost for all participants. And by reducing the cost for all participants, we're also reducing the cost for all Oregonians. Finally, our new state motto is that Oregon loves dreamers. OPDP is turning a dream into a reality, and you can visit our website at www.opdp.org, and you could download an application on that website, and that's my spiel.
Good. Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Okay. Bruce?
No, I just, you know, it's a great program. We're going to be able to provide, we believe, really substantive discounts to Oregonians that need access to affordable prescription drugs the most, you know, individuals who are low income without health insurance and prescription drug coverage. A great program, and you know, my understanding is the bill today is really more of an administrative issue around the way the bill was originally drafted. And I'm sure Holly and others will explain that far better than I.
Okay. Good. Any questions, comments? Okay. Would you just sit up front here in case we need to?
Sure.
Don Stetcher and Jim Markey, would you please come up? Introduce yourselves, of course, and then you can talk about the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of Pharma, and to my right is Don Stetcher with the Novartis Company, a member group. We're here to support the Dash 1 amendments. I believe that the original language that was contained under this act relative to rules, there was some question as to constitutionality. This amendment would simply say that rules adopted under this program would be submitted to the Legislative Assembly and would go into effect on January 1 of the following year, unless the Legislative Assembly acted affirmatively to change that, either by changing the effective date or amending or repealing or supplementing the rule. This kind of a procedure is actually used with the Council on Court Procedures relative to rules established for courts and has worked pretty well. The Judiciary Committee reviews their rules. That's run by a gentleman down at the University of Oregon, the council is, and they adopt rules regularly throughout the interim, and then they're reviewed by the Judiciary Committee and either changed or if the legislature doesn't act affirmatively, then they take effect. So we would favor this concept. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Don Stetcher. I'm an associate director of government affairs for Novartis Pharmaceuticals. I'm speaking today on behalf of Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers of America. I'm the chair of the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers Association Task Force here in Oregon. And I was in on the many work groups in the 03 session as then Senate Bill 875 was crafted. It was a very collaborative, bipartisan effort conceived and driven by legislators, and my understanding of Senate Bill 623 is that this ensures that the legislature retains oversight of the program, and of course Pharma is supportive of that.
Okay. Question? I guess the question that I have is this, I think, do you recommend this as standard procedure for every bill the legislature passes in relation to administrative rules?
Mr. Chair, I feel I'm being baited. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, I don't think that would be such a bad idea, but I'm sure there would be others who would disagree with that concept.
But there must be... Is there a reason why we are doing it with this particular bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I feel that our client felt that some legislative oversight of this program was important, and this provides that.
Your client didn't show up today, though, right? Is your client here?
Mr. Gardner?
Yes.
Mr. Gardner is involved in another meeting, so...
I was hoping he would be here because this is a significant piece of legislation. I wanted him to take credit for this piece of legislation. So I was really.
Well, I know you did, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Both Mr. Gardner and Mr. Marquis represent Pharma.
Oh, okay. So was this your idea or was it Mr. Gardner's?
I was not involved in the drafting of this amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Holly Robinson, would you come up, please, and talk about the bill and the amendments that are the Dash 1 amendments. Let's start with the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council, and I'm not here to talk about the policy decision about whether or not the Legislative Assembly wants oversight over an agency's rule adoption process, but if that policy decision were adopted, how to do it constitutionally versus unconstitutionally. And there are, as Mr. Marquis said, constitutional ways of doing it and unconstitutional ways of doing it, and I feel like if the point is to have me say, yeah, Holly, you did it wrong last time, then I will confess that I did. In the bill as originally enacted at Senate Bill 25, it allowed the program, the Department of Administrative Services, to adopt rules, have those rules go into effect, and then if the Legislative Assembly came in behind them and attempted to repeal those rules, that's where there's a constitutional problem. And so there's confusion around the word what adopt means. So if the agency were to adopt the rules but they don't go into effect, sort of like the way we do operative dates. Mm-hmm. Then the legislature can come in behind that agency and look at those rules and determine whether or not they want those rules to go into effect or not, and they do that by statute. As Mr. Marquis said, the Council on Court Procedures has been using this process for some period of time successfully, as has the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in doing the guidelines rule. So an agency, it's constitutional for an agency to propose a rule and adopt them but not have them go into effect and then have the legislature come behind them and determine whether or not they want those rules to go into effect or not. And the Dash 1 amendments, well, the bill, when the issue came up this session, the job of the Assembly was to approve the rules, otherwise they would be repealed. When it was pointed out to me that the error of my ways, I determined that it made more sense to repeal the offending section as opposed to having the legislature approve the rules, the end result is the same, which is the rules that were adopted for this program would continue to be effective. So it got the assembly into the same place of having, of approving the rules, but it did it constitutionally. What the Dash 1 amendments is basically continue that process and say any rules that are adopted from this point forward regarding the program would be adopted by the agency or by the program, but would not in fact become effective until the legislature had a chance to look at them, and then if the legislature did nothing, then in fact the rules would become effective following the next legislative session.
Okay. Now, that then obviously has no effect on the rules that have been previously adopted by the agency, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, in the way that this, in the way that we have constructed this and constructed the amendments, the current rules with the repeal of Section 8, Chapter 714, Oregon Laws 2003, which is what you did last time, those rules would stay in effect, and the new provisions, the Dash 1s, would apply to only to apply to rules that the agency proposed after the effective date of this, of the new act, which is what the requesters, who's not here today, asked me to do. So it allows them to go forward with their current rules, but should they want to change them, they could propose changes, but they would not go into effect until the next legislative assembly met.
Okay. Questions? Comments? Is this a solution looking for a problem? No. Bruce, would you come up, please? And Holly, if you would just stay there in case we have to pursue this further. This is, I think, a kind of a no-trust situation, is that you, we don't want you to do something that the legislature can't monitor very, 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 very closely. What impact does this have on your ability to run a program?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, you know, we certainly run a program in an open manner. We've established rules for the program. We've had public hearings about those rules. You know, we work cooperatively with the legislature, and I believe that the legislature has always had and always does have the opportunity to enact legislation to change the program should the legislature so desire. You know, my sense about this is that, you know, we would just like to have the opportunity to be able to move forward in an administratively efficient manner, and to be able to adopt rules, have a public hearing about those rules, put those rules into effect, and carry forth the program in the most administratively effective manner, so that we're not spending a tremendous amount of time doing work, as you said, that's really a solution looking for a problem.
So you would like to continue the legislative process as it currently exists. I guess I have to rephrase that. I asked earlier if we should do this with all the programs, if there's any kind of a program passed by the legislature, do we have this kind of oversight of administrative rules? Now, I get quite often, once a week or so, I get letters notices of administrative rule hearing, and we sometimes I go and sometimes I don't. I am proposing to one agency that we had a hearing for a couple weeks ago that maybe we really don't need this bill. Maybe what you need to do is make the administrative rules to change the program to do what needs to be done without the legislative oversight. But if we pass this amendment, that is going to change the nature of your administrative rulemaking.
Yes, Chair Moore said, I've always operated as if I do have legislative oversight, as does every single state agency, and that's how we have operated and will continue to operate.
Okay.
Quite frankly, I don't, from where I sit, I don't see the need for an assurance of that oversight. You already have that oversight.
Okay. Yes. Senator Cruz.
Bruce, do the Dash 1s prevent you from doing your job?
Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, no, they wouldn't prevent us from doing our job.
Okay, I guess, Mr. Chair, it's just the work group product called for legislative oversight, and for the next time around the loop to eliminate that, it kind of is a break of faith, which is why we have the Dash 1s. Now, I will admit, Mr. Chair, that having it sunset without the legislature weighing in on it may have been a problem, but I think the Dash 1s address that too.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Thank you. Others wishing to testify? Yeah, okay, that's good. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623, and we will open. Which one is here? Oh, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 553. And Senator Morris, would you like to come up, please? I mentioned at the beginning that we're going to interrupt what we're doing to allow Senator Morris to testify, and then we will go back to.
Thank you, yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and particularly thank you for the courtesies extended to interrupt your schedule. Senate Bill 553 is a very straightforward, simple bill, and we do have a Dash 1 amendment that I think are improvements to the bill. The initial intent was to expand the what is a seven-member health licensing office advisory council on hearing aids from one consumer advocate to two consumer advocates. The amendment changes the original bill from leaving one consumer advocate in place and adding one member who in the member's occupation provides services to consumers of hearing aids but receives no compensation related to sales of hearing aids. This bill I have sponsored at the request of a constituent, and I believe that it makes sense to me that the commission be balanced. I think that's the interest that we would all have. Currently it does not change the tilt of the commission. The majority of the members are from the you might say directly the hearing aid providers community. Two members are professional nature. One would be a consumer and one would be one who essentially receives no compensation in assisting members or assisting persons with hearing aid and hearing problems. So I believe, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is a reasonable bill. I understand that it's not a new bill. This has come in previous sessions, but it seems to me to be reasonable and would ask for your support.
This is at the request of the Self-Help for Hard of Hearing People of Oregon.
Yes.
And they perceive a problem, do they?
That I believe is the case in terms of the balance on the commission.
Have you had an opportunity to delve into this in terms of a perceived problem? Okay, let me rephrase that, because we introduce oftentimes bills for constituents as a courtesy. Sometimes we introduce them without ownership. Other times we introduce them and take ownership of the bill itself because we feel strongly about it and have looked into it. Now, where are you in that spectrum?
I would fall, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would fall more in terms of an advocate for the position of my constituent. Okay. With respect to this bill. I believe it's important to have balance on these commissions, and I believe this helps achieve a greater balance than presently exists. Now, in terms of my own personal experience, and to explain specific problems, no, I can't do that. But those members that, if they are in the audience here when you open the public testimony,
and we will do that,
yeah.
I do appreciate your position, because I also have bills that I introduce on behalf of constituents, and sometimes it is simply a courtesy to get the bill introduced, and other times I feel strongly, but I understand where you're coming from.
I might, Mr. Chairman, comment with respect to the intent of this amendment. And it's stated by Andy Evans. We anticipate that the new seat would be filled by a consumer advocate from a field such as nursing, geriatric specialist, social or vocational rehabilitation, counseling, education, senior center workers, or the like. That's their expectation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I do appreciate your
other questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing right now on Bill 553. We'll come back to that later, but I do want to go back, and I will open the public hearing, not a work session, but for the public hearing on the bill that we just left, Senate Bill 623. Others wishing to testify on this bill. I guess I will then really close that public hearing. I wasn't sure if there were other people who came in who wanted to testify, and I would like to stand at ease for a moment while we take a look at this. 418.
Did we do this, Senator?
Yes.
Senate Bill 418 defines terms used in the bill, allows a state personal income tax deduction for an amount paid or incurred for hearing aids purchased by a taxpayer for a dependent child. It allows deductions to be the lesser of the amount incurred or $500 for each hearing impaired ear for which the hearing aid was purchased. Allows the claim for replacement hearing aid only if purchased a replacement hearing aid is 36 months or more after purchase of hearing aid for which credit was last claimed. Prohibits claim in excess of tax liability. Establishes treatment for a non-resident. Allows tax credit not used by taxpayer in a particular year to be carried forward up to several years, I think up to four, and applies to tax year beginning January 2006. This does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can I just make a comment first?
Just for a record on 418, because the description that was read by Mr. Bertobian, is not what the bill does in that first paragraph. So I just want to make sure that that needs to be changed. It finds the description of the measure allows a state personal income tax deduction. As I read the bill, the bill is an income tax credit, which is far different than a deduction. Credit means the taxpayers pay for it. Deduction means you get the deducted, which is about one-ninth as much.
When I read the bill, I saw credit.
Okay. But the bill says credit, but the measure description calls it a deduction.
Make sure that... Thank you, sir. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rick. Senator Metzger. Okay. George Scheller and Fred Peters, would you please come up, please? Okay. We have... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people to testify. If you have written testimony, which you have, it would be helpful to summarize if it's very, very lengthy, but please go ahead and introduce yourselves before you start.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Mostet and members of the Human Service Committee. My name is George Scheller, and I live in Albany, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association for the Deaf.
Okay.
I wear a hearing aid and have worn one since the age of 12, when I lost my hearing with a cold and a high fever. And I only wear one in my right ear because I have no hearing left in my left ear. Over the years, I've put the expenses of my hearing aid on my tax return as a medical deduction. Senate Bill 418 is asking to treat it as a credit on our tax return instead of a medical deduction. And the Oregon Association for the Deaf is in support of that, but asking that you change this to not just cover children, but to cover all people who purchase hearing aids. The cost of a hearing aid is very expensive nowadays. Over $1,000 for an aid, and you've got upkeeps on it all the time too. But the purchase of an aid as a credit would be a great help to us, because those of us in the deaf community have to spend a lot of other money on a lot of other things. Flashing doorbells, flashing fire alarms, and telecommunication equipment, and all these other special devices that we cannot deduct on our taxes at all. A hearing aid is permitted because it is a medical prescribed thing. Most doctors have to prescribe it in order to get it. But these other devices that we have to pay all the time and upkeep are not a medical thing. They're just stuff that we need to live with and make our lives easier for us. So what we're asking is that the members, we support the bill, but we ask you to expand on it to not just only for children, but to include adults also. Thank you, and I'll answer any question you have.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and committee members and senators, I thank you for this opportunity to speak to these bills that are now coming before the Senate. My name is Fred Peters. I'm a resident in Polk County. I'm a consumer representative on the Hearing Aid Licensure Council, but I do not at this hearing represent or speak for the council. I'm speaking as a concerned private consumer. Hearing loss is an extremely isolating and separating event that causes separation even among loved ones. My hearing loss finally was needed to be addressed post-retirement. None of my family required hearing assistance from infancy, and for this I've been very grateful. But you see, I'm not certain how we would have managed to get our children the help that they needed if they would have needed it. And this bill addresses that. We would have somehow done it, but a portion of our family well-being would have suffered. Presently, the cost of hearing aids require an outlay of anywhere between $1,000 to $3,000 per fitted ear. This is a significant amount of money which a family must come up with, and with no hope of any assistance coming from elsewhere. Do I need to tell you then that I applaud the presence of Senate Bill 418 and 419, strongly recommend their passage into law.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Next. Eric Frederick, Suzanne Collins, could you please come up?
Good afternoon, Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. I'm here to express my support for...
Identify yourself.
I am Eric Frederick. I'm a doctor of audiology from Portland. I work for a nonprofit clinic. And I'm here today representing the Oregon Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, or OSHA. OSHA is an organization of over 600 speech and language pathologists and audiologists. I'll be very brief in my testimony. I know you've got a full slate today.
Okay.
But I hope that my testimony will be very valuable as you determine your position on these bills. Hearing loss is one of the most common birth defects in the U.S. It's a medical condition that usually is most effectively treated by hearing aids. Approximately one child in 300 born in this state will have a hearing loss at birth. That means that in the state of Oregon, there are currently approximately 26,000 kids, birth to 18, who are born with a hearing loss. Although this is a medical condition that is incredibly common, most insurances do not cover hearing aids, and that leaves the parent or social service agencies holding the bag for providing treatment for this hearing loss. Hearing aids are a major expense, and one that young parents often are not able to absorb with all of the other expenses associated with a new child. To make matters worse, the sickest children, those that spend time in the neonatal intensive care unit, are 10 times as likely to have a congenital hearing loss as other children. That means that the parents who are facing the largest medical bills upon the birth of their child are the ones who are most likely to also face a large out-of-pocket expense to treat their child's hearing loss. In my job, I've watched parents make the difficult decision of needing to delay treatment for their child simply because they can't afford it. The problem is there's a very short, critical period where kids are primed, where their brains are primed to learn speech and language. A recent study was done that found that children who received amplification in the forms of hearing aids prior to age 6 months did much better than those kids who received hearing aids later in life. Treating hearing loss early in the first 6 months of life results in better educational outcomes, better speech and language development, and better vocational outcomes later in life. In short, if we do not treat the hearing loss early on, we're shifting a lot of our burden onto our educational system and our government agencies. This is an area where we can spend a little money up front to save a lot of money in the long run. I ask you to support Senate Bill 418.
Thank you. Question?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Collins, and I am here today as a parent of a child with severe to profound hearing loss. Jacob was diagnosed at 3.5, and quite a shock, as you can imagine, to young parents with a child with hearing loss. And so then I did some research as far as what kind of insurance and other things would be available, and found quite surprisingly that there was not a lot of help for hearing aids. They are quite expensive, and all the other things that go along with hearing aids, such as molds that you need to get twice a year, batteries that you have to buy every 2 weeks because that's as long as they last, hearing aid dryers, air blowers, and just a lot of other things that go with them. Thank you.
Questions? We have a group in Lane County. It's called EC Cares, and they deal with children with hearing losses and autism and other incidents that make it difficult to develop normally, and they emphasize, Doctor, what you said is that the sounds early on in development are extremely important, and the importance of early diagnosis and early treatment. So I understand that. So I appreciate both of you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea Gavins and Scott Austin, if you could come up, please.
I think so. Chair Morissette and committee members, I'm Scott Austin. I represent the Oregon Hearing Society. Okay. We're an organization for hearing aid specialists and dispensers in the state. I also serve as the vice chair of the Hearing Aid Council on Hearing Aids, the Advisory Council on Hearing Aids through the Health Licensing Office. We're simply here today to support this bill. We feel it is a benefit to the hearing impaired. while it originally was written just for children, we would also support the help for adults as well. Just for information, there is currently a bill in the U.S. Senate by Senator Norm Coleman presenting an identical plan for a federal tax credit, as well as a bill in the House of Representatives by Representative Jim Ryan, former Olympic star. Identical bills on both sides in the federal government. They don't know where they're going, but we think that getting it started at the state level is the right thing to do.
Good. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah. Chairman Morissette,
yes.
Committee members. My name is Andy Evans. I hope I'm the right one. It sounded like you invited somebody else up here.
Evans.
Right.
I
live in Philomath. I'm a hard of hearing consumer. I'm also a member of the self-help for Oregon for hard of hearing people, and also a board member of Oregon's self-help for hard of hearing people, which is what we call SHORE. So I've submitted some written testimony here. I've also sent that via email to the members of the committee, and I've also sent some from Dr. Mitch Turbin, who couldn't be here today, but wanted to be heard as well. Now, there's a few comments that I'd like to add to that. Yes. In our organization of SHORE and in SHHH, the national organization, we're all volunteers with the exception of the national director and a small staff in his office. And we volunteer our time and energy and money to support others like ourselves who have to cope with a tilted field in life. The most evil manifestation of a hearing loss is as a communication disorder. And this communication disorder not only affects the individual with the hearing loss, but it also affects the other parties in that communication. That's spouses, families, workplaces, and the public. The three bills, I'll combine these comments for all of the three bills that are relevant to this that we're hearing today. The three bills that have brought us here today are low-hanging fruit in helping a large percentage of the public towards healthier, happier lives in spite of hearing loss, especially children in the most crucial period of their development. We know from our own experiences that gaining as much parity as possible with regard to access to the hearing world has its rewards. We feel these bills have their rewards too, for individuals and for public health and happiness, and for the abilities of individuals to hold jobs and to support families and pay taxes. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 418. Now, interestingly, we have another bill dealing with the same issue, only this is an insurance bill that would require insurance companies to cover hearing aids. Referring to Senate Bill 418, which we just heard, I'm not sure if we have a revenue impact. I mean, this is not a fiscal impact because it's not going to cost the state anything up front. But what it will do is add to the $28 billion tax expenditure. We have approximately $12 billion general fund, and we have a $28 billion tax expenditure for tax credits of various kinds, and so we have to consider this as a fiscal impact in many ways. There are other bills before us this session which also will ask for tax credits. So I would like to, I'm not going to go into a public hearing at this moment, I would like to open the public hearing in just a moment on 419 to finish the testimony from some of you who are here for that. However, we will go back to the beginning, wherever that is. Senate Bill 623, and I would like to open a public hearing one more time on this. And Dr. Bruce Goldberg, would you please come up and enlighten us?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Health Policy. It is springtime. it's baseball season. One can only think about Yogi Berra, and this is deja vu all over again. I come to you actually apologetically and to amend my previous testimony to Senator Cruz. He had asked me a question: would the Dash 1 amendments inhibit the ability to operate the program? And actually, I had just only had a moment to review the bill, and I truly apologize for having to come back and amend the testimony, but having the opportunity to read through this bill, it actually is pretty clear in the Dash 1s that it would inhibit the ability to run the program, and let me explain why. What this would call for is that should the program need to adopt a new rule this coming September, an issue were to come up that would require some rule, and we had a public testimony and adopted some rules, those rules actually wouldn't go into effect until the legislature came back in session a year and a half from now. That would actually delay the implementation of any rule a year and a half. That would very much hamper the efficient running of any program, and while I appreciate the concern about legislative oversight, this would indeed really dramatically inhibit the ability to run a program. So I just wanted the opportunity to amend my answer to Senator Cruz, and I apologize for not having done a better job at reading this.
Thank you very much. And when I read the amendment, it was really unclear to me what it meant, because we didn't get this amendment until recently, and we did have Ms. Robinson down here to explain it, and my question still remains. It is, seems to be a solution looking for a problem, and I don't know that we have a problem. So, with that,
I'm sorry I wasn't here right at the very beginning for the main part of the bill, and I wanted to know that we do need the main part of the bill in order to continue the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, Senator Monsanto, that's correct. What 623 did was really amend what was an error in the drafting of the original bill.
Thank you.
Okay, I have to wait till staff gets back. Now we're out looking for a vice chair, but I am going to open a work session and pass, and hopefully we will vote and pass the bill as it has been drafted. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 623. Let's see.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion of the motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We've been discussing the various options, and I thought we were going to be given a little more time to come up with something appropriate.
Well, you were out of the room when Dr. Goldberg restated his position, and I will repeat some of the comments that I made. I think this is a solution looking for a problem. I know there's a lot of distrust going on in this building concerning prescription drugs, and we had lengthy hearings last session, and as a result of that, Senator Minnis was successful in making a point that there was some administrative rules drafted in the past that probably shouldn't have been drafted, and those were corrected. This program has started today, and already we're arguing over whether or not it should succeed. We're already questioning this whole thing, and we have 1,300 people who've signed up. We anticipate getting 22,000 hopefully by the end of the year. This is a good program, and these rules will if any administrative rules come up, that they will not be able to go forward. Now, any normal agency, and I mentioned this earlier, draft administrative rules as they see the need to draft them. Then they post a hearing and people can show up and testify as to whether or not that is a legitimate administrative rule. It is an open process. The legislature can always come in and override administrative rules. And as I mentioned before, I'm dealing with one agency administrator and I'm urging him to go the administrative rule route. And if we do a bill, it will only be to set parameters, so to speak, but I have great trust in administrative rules. And if we don't, we are micromanaging, is I guess what I'm saying, is I don't know if it's the legislator's role to micromanage administrative rules. If you change the rules, then it won't go into effect until the legislature comes back at some point to approve the rules that may be necessary to run the program. And I think that is a micromanagement thing. And I understand the reason for it is because there is a lot of distrust going on. But I would like us to pass the bill as it was redrafted by our administrator, and we hope that it will not die in the House, which it may. I guess that's a chance we take. But if it does, we will respond, I guess, and deal with that when it happens. Other comments?
Yes. I guess running the risk of the program completely going away as the rule is currently written is, or as the law is currently written, is problematic. I also look at the fact that the work group product included legislative oversight, and you're talking about trust in the process, and we're immediately, first chance we get, removing legislative oversight. I will admit the dash ones are not written properly, and they're much, much too restrictive. I think there is a compromise solution in here, and we've been talking about it, and we think we have it. We would just need to get it written. I guess, Mr. Chair, I understand, you know, this program, if we put forth an amendment or we don't put forth an amendment, the program as it's currently constituted goes forward, and it's a very positive thing. I don't think that having legislative oversight, and you're right, we get notice of administrative rule hearings all the time, and I'm not pointing this at Dr. Goldberg in any way, shape, or form, because he is about as inclusive as anybody I've dealt with, and you need to be applauded for that, Bruce. But there are other agencies that don't operate that way, and personally I think the legislature should have more oversight of administrative rules, because we create law. The administrative rules have the force of law. And it's appropriate that they are within the scope of the intent that the legislature intended. That doesn't always happen. I do believe that there is something in between the printed bill and the dash ones that would work for us, and which is why I had requested that we have a week to try to come up with a solution.
Okay. You were out of the room when I think Dr. Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. You were off, and I will accept your recommendation.
We have most of the people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just say then,
Mr.
that...
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I move that we table a motion.
Okay.
First.
Okay. Thank you. I will... we have an undisputable motion to table, and I guess what I was just going to say is I was going to ask for remove the motion, because I don't want this to create a rift. Because we're going to
have a point of order.
Yes.
I need clarification. There is a motion on the floor. I made it and I have not rescinded it.
Okay.
And therefore, I need to have a point of clarification. Do we go forward?
Okay. Mr. Parliamentarian. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment, please. You want to call the... to approve the bill as it was written, which was overridden by a motion to table. We must vote on the motion to table first, and I guess I would, in all due respect to my colleague who made the motion, who I asked to make the motion, I would want to approve the motion to table so we can give it another shot and see if we can come up with something that is workable. And if it is not workable in the eyes of, I think, the administrator, if it puts up a roadblock to efficiently running the program, then I will bring back the bill as written and ask that we pass it. I don't want this bill to die in the House because we've created some hard feelings. And we're well aware of that. We're well aware of that. And so I want to be able to finesse this thing, if possible, if there's still any finesse left. So we will vote on the motion to table. Those in favor say aye. Please call the roll.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Metzger? Aye.
Senator Monica Anderson?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morris?
Aye. Okay. Good. The motion has been the bill. The motion to proceed has been tabled, and I appreciate the participation of the group. Okay, we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 419, which is the other part of the hearing aid bill. George. I guess we have pretty much. Okay. George Scheffler and Fred Peters, would you please come up? Okay. George, would you like to go ahead, please?
Good afternoon, Chairman Mosett and members of the committee. My name is George Schiller, and I'm from Albany, Oregon, and I'm not going to repeat what I said the first time a while ago. Anyway, first off, I'd like to say is that I'm probably one of the most fortunate persons who has an insurance that will cover the cost of my hearing aid. The hearing aid I presently have costs $1,300, and I paid a $50 copayment, and the insurance company paid the balance of it. I can apply for another new hearing aid in 5 years. It's only in 5-year phrases that my insurance will cover this hearing aid. But there are a lot of other health insurances that will not cover the cost of a hearing aid. But they will cover the cost of a cochlear implant, which is $60,000 for one of those.
Wow.
And their insurance will cover electric wheelchairs, $20,000. There's a lot of things that insurances will cover, but something like a hearing aid, they will not cover. And so I think the Oregon Association for the Deaf is supporting this bill that the insurance companies be required to cover the cost of hearing aid. But in this bill, it's for children, is what it is. And again, the Oregon Association for the Deaf feels that it should be for all people who purchase hearing aids. With today's world, people are living longer, which means with aging, you're going to have hearing loss, which means more and more people are going to need hearing aids and things like that. And when you get to your retirement ages, that's when you really need good insurance to cover things like this. So the Oregon Association of Deaf is asking that you pass this bill so that insurance companies will be required to cover hearing aids, not just for children, but for adults also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eric Fredrickson.
Good
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Eric Frederick, here representing Oregon Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, a member organization of approximately 600 speech-language pathologists and audiologists. Most of my prior testimony on Senate Bill 418 is equally applicable to 419, so I'll simply give one small addition and let you get on with business today. Earlier, I spoke to the fact that hearing loss is a common medical condition, a medical condition that arises from a damaged auditory physiology. In spite of this fact, most medical insurances do not cover the most effective treatment for this problem. By allowing medical insurances to avoid covering treatment of this condition, what we are in essence doing is shifting the financial burden away from the medical insurance and onto private citizens who are paying out of pocket or government agencies that are then dealing with the fallout from untreated hearing loss. This is a real issue that arises and costs us a lot of money in special education to try to remediate this problem if the hearing loss has gone untreated, as well as it costs us a lot of money in our vocational rehabilitation services later on in life, as well as reducing our tax income from people who go on to be less productive citizens in their adult life. I ask that you support Senate Bill 419.
Thank you. Andrew Evans.
Thanks again, Chairman Morissette, and also other members of the committee. Again, my name is Andy Evans, and I am a hard of hearing consumer, and I also represent Self-Help for Hard of Hearing People in Oregon. I won't repeat my testimony from last time, but I will add some of the passage of my email that I distributed earlier. I lost my hearing at approximately age 2 and have experienced firsthand many struggles as a hard of hearing person. I've also experienced tremendous benefit from hearing aids and rehabilitative opportunities. As a child, I experienced not having effective hearing aids because they were beyond the means of my parents to afford. I can also say that I would not be capable of my current job opportunities if I did not have hearing assistance. In the U.S., only about 20% of the people who could be benefiting from hearing aids are using them. And one of the main reasons for that is cost. I have a really good job, but they don't cover, our insurance does not cover hearing aids. And I think for kids, as has been provided in previous testimony and my own, I think it's the most crucial time to offer that assistance, to guarantee that they have that help that will level the playing field for them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 419, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 553. Okay, George. Okay, George. And Fred Peters, is Fred going to testify on this bill? Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairman Moses and members of the committee. My name's George Shiller, and I'm from Albany, Oregon, and again, I've got a hearing loss. Okay, on Senate Bill 553, it's asking to add one more consumer to the Hearing Aid Council. At the present time, the council has, four members who are hearing aid dealers, and one member who is a doctor, and only one consumer. Oregon has a population of approximately 3,504,700 people, and statistics say that 10.3% of them have a hearing loss. So we feel, the Oregon Association for the Deaf feels that the balance on that council is a little off. The hearing aid dealers have got a monopoly on this council. and we would like to add one more consumer to that council to give it a little more of a balance. So the Oregon Association for the Deaf is in asking you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Fred Peters. I live in Polk County. And these are my observations.
Okay. I'm sorry, Fred. Senator Starr?
Yes, I'd like to know whether or not you support the bill with the amendment.
E or George?
Support the bill with the amendment. What amendment are you talking about?
Yes, he'll read the amendment, yes.
The proposed Dash 1 amendment would restore that only one member of advisory council is a consumer of hearing aids, and that one member, and then it modifies that one member of the advisory council is person whose occupation provides services to consumers of hearing aids but receives no compensation related to sales of hearing aids.
So, can you? In other words, if that person is not a hearing aid dealer,
correct.
Yes, we will support that amendment. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Would you continue your testimony, please, and answer the same question, if you would?
Would you want me to answer that same question?
Yes.
Yes, I would support that amendment.
Okay. Okay.
Senate Bill 553 is aimed at improving consumer advocacy on the Health Licensing Agency's Advisory Council on Hearing Aids. This seven-member council seems to have a twofold goal, and the first is a little bit lengthy. It's testing that leads to licensure, legislating and enforcing this legislation, and then second, responding to consumer concern. One member of this council is a medical doctor whose specialty is eye, ear, nose, and throat. One member is a licensed audiologist. Four members are licensed hearing aid specialists. And one member is a hearing aid consumer at the present time. With the stated mission of the Health Licensing Office being the protection and concern for the consumer, which is written on their brochure that is available to everyone, I see this as being disproportionately heavy with hearing aid specialists. There ought to be one other consumer on that board. Hearing aid dealers receive the most complaints of any professional monitored by the Health Licensing Office. I think this is worthwhile noting. Obviously, the hearing aid industry is not policing itself, and I feel that there would be another consumer who would perhaps balance that out a little bit.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Andrew Evans, Scott Austin. Yeah. Well, let's. Okay, Andrew, you go first, then, and then we'll have these two gentlemen come up. So go ahead.
Thanks again, Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. Again, my name is Andy Evans, and I'm a hearing aid consumer. I live in Philomath, Oregon, and I represent Self-Help for Hard of Hearing People of Oregon. So this is the bill that Senator Morse wrote at our request and also amended at our request. SB 553 is aimed at improving consumer advocacy in the Health License Agency's Advisory Council on Hearing Aids. This agency's stated mission is to protect the consumer. Yet, the seven-member advisory council consists of only one consumer and a built-in majority of four dealers who are calling themselves hearing instrument specialists, but would be more clearly cloaked as folks who derive income from the sales of hearing aids. We urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, gentlemen, would you please come up and now pass it.
Chair Morissette, committee members, I'm Scott Austin. Today, representing the Oregon Hearing Society, Trade Association for Hearing Aid Specialists, a term that we changed from dealers last year, or 2 years ago in the legislature. But today, and I also serve as the vice chair of the Health Licensing Office Advisory Council on Hearing Aids. However, I'm not representing that council today in my testimony. I have testified for the previous three legislative sessions on a similar bill to change the makeup of the council. And I've been on the council for many years now and have sat in for the last 18 years for council meetings. The advisory council is strictly that. It's an advisory council. It's not a policy board. We don't make policy. We advise the Health Licensing Office. And most often our issues that come to us are technically oriented issues. They are examination issues, fitting issues, situations of the proper testing equipment, and those things. And while we take the full responsibility of consumer protection as our number one goal, we also spend most of our time on non-consumer related issues. Taking away one position would add more work for the volunteer hearing aid specialists that do serve on the committee, in the works of committees that they would be working on. And we don't really see any perceived problems at the council. We have most recently included more public participation by bringing some of the groups that represent the hearing impaired, putting them on a permanent agenda platform for there to bring their opinions to the council. We want to hear that. We encourage that. And we don't see any need for any change again this year.
Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Brennan, and I represent the Oregon Hearing Society, and I don't have any testimony to give. I think Mr. Austin covered the points that we wanted to cover.
Go ahead. I want you to go back just a minute.
Sure.
You mentioned that this is the third year that this bill has come out, the third session.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right, yes.
And
both of those were on the House side, I believe, okay. Before. Senator Cruz.
What do you suppose motivates people coming back?
I'm all for consumer protection. I'm all for consumer involvement.
Mm-hmm.
If we were a policy board making council, I would say that would make a lot more sense to have the public involved. But we're more of a technical advisory committee, and we don't really see the need for that. As far as the amendment, I don't know what technical expertise a non-dispensing licensed professional or nurse or geriatric professional would bring to that committee that a hearing impaired person couldn't bring to that committee as well. So the amendment to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
Questions?
Okay. No, I'm just going to point out, you're asking, I've got a bill on pinnipeds that I've dropped four sessions in a row now, so sometimes you just keep going.
Okay. So I will close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On Senate Bill 553, would you pass your papers down? I don't know that we have a constitutional majority to take action today on any of these bills. So we will not have a work session, and we will come back at some point for a work session unless someone wants to take a chance. Yes. Okay.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. Okay. So we're just going to close the public hearing, and now, did you want to go back to anything? You say we have a compromise, but we'll do that later. Okay, we will carry Senate Bill 623. We're going to carry Senate Bill 623 over until Thursday.
If we get the amendment,
yes. And we will possibly come back to the work session on these three bills. And I think, Mr. Brenneman, you have to touch bases with everybody on the committee to make sure we have the votes to pass these bills. Right now, it's questionable. And, yes, if you would come up, please. We're missing a person, so I don't know that... Okay, public hearing on 553.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent the Oregon Hearing Society. I have not gotten commitments either way from anybody on the committee, although I've talked to everybody on the committee, to express our position that we don't want to lose a member.
Yeah.
And I haven't asked... Okay. For a position from anyone, and I don't know what that is.
Yeah, okay. Frank Morris introduced the bill, and I think that there are people who support the bill. There are some that don't support the bill. We're missing one member. I'm not sure. We don't have a clear sign on this bill, and I would like to... Let me then restate... I will carry this bill over until Thursday, which is the 3rd, and that's Senate Bill. Is that the right one? No, we're going to do 553 is the one we're going to carry over.
Those two also.
Okay, we will have a public... We will have a work session, up or down, on Thursday on Senate Bill 41. 418 and 419 and 553. We will deal with these bills on Thursday, one way or the other. It's unclear right now. We're missing one person, and we don't have the votes to pass. We can defeat them, but we can't pass.
623 is going over.
623 will come back on Thursday as well. So we'll... If we have the amendments on
Thursday,
we're going to schedule it. Okay.
Yeah.
And with that, I will close one of the strangest sessions. Pleasure to chair.